Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 559, titled The Opus Dei Code, subtitled The Vatican Rag, Part 3. This program is being recorded on June 18th of the year 2006. What we're going to be doing in this broadcast is taking a look once again at some of the influence in society of the Opus Dei organization. That is a lay organization within the Vatican that became a special Vatican prelature under Pope John Paul II. It reports now only to the Pope. And as we looked at in side one, not only does Opus Dei have a strong fascist heritage and an ultra-reactionary agenda on the current political scene, but it wields profound influence in conjunction with other clandestine fascist elements on not only the last pope, or it wielded influence on the last pope, it wields great influence on the current pope as well. And that isn't the only place that it wields influence. It has a growing influence within the American legislative situation, and specifically, as we're about to see, an Opus Dei think tank at Princeton University had a lot to do with information that was channeled onto the Senate floor and into the debate about the Marriage Protection Amendment, and the deliverer of this not-so-good news was none other than Senator Sam Brownback, a Republican from Kansas. Now note, as we're going to examine the Opus Dei heritage of the Witherspoon Institute, bearing in mind the history of Opus Dei that we looked at in Side 1 and other broadcasts on the subject, bear in mind that Juan Tellez, the head of the Institute, is what is known in Opus Dei as a numerary. Basically, he takes a vow of celibacy, and he not only doesn't marry, he doesn't have sex, period. And this is the individual who presides over the institution that if it had its way, dictate to others who can and who cannot marry. It's also particularly ironic in light of the priest molestation scandals that have come to light in connection with the Catholic Church. The following article is by Bob Geiger. It appeared on the Democrats.com website on June 14th in 2006. This article is titled, Is Brownback Bringing Opus Dei into the Senate? And it reads, The United States Senate is often called the greatest deliberative body in the world, unquote, which usually raises the bar on the tenor and intellectual content of speeches given on the floor and for the official record. Not so for Senator Sam Brownback, Republican of Kansas, who took to the Senate floor last week to deliver a strident push for the bigoted Marriage Protection Amendment with massive distortions of the issue, and an argument that was based almost solely on the opinion of a little-known conservative think tank affiliated with the Roman Catholic organization Opus Dei. Quote, The problem we have in front of us is that the institution of marriage has been weakened, and the effort to redefine it on this vast social experiment that we have going on, redefining marriage differently than it has ever been defined before, unquote, the Kansas senator grimly intoned last week. Again, continuing with Senator Brownback. Actually, I would perhaps nickname him Senator Brownshirt under the circumstances, but then that's just me. But Senator Brownback slash Shirt's statements continue. This effort of this vast social experiment, the early data that we see from other places, harms the institution of the family, the raising of the next generation, and it is harmful to the future of the Republic, unquote. Brownback then went on to give figures for how various states have shown their hatred of gay people with their own prohibitions on same-sex marriage, and used that as his rationale for a similar amendment to the U.S. Constitution. But Brownback really hit his stride when he described a paper called 10 Principles on Marriage and the Public Good, unquote, published by a fairly new and extremely conservative group at Princeton University. By the way, parenthetically, I would note that Princeton University is where Prince Hans Adam of Liechtenstein, associated with the Habsburgs, himself a reactionary Catholic, and I have seen allegations on the Internet that he himself is Opus Dei, whether or not that's true. He also opened his kinder, gentler think tank at Princeton University. Princeton, a very, very interesting university in terms of grooming future generations of operatives on the clandestine scene. Returning to, once again, the use of an Opus Dei generated document by Senator Brownshirt, my nickname for Senator Brownback. But Brownback really hits his stride when he described a paper called 10 Principles on Marriage and the Public Good, published by a fairly new and extremely conservative group at Princeton University. According to Brownback, the paper is, quote, an important statement of principles from top American scholars to be considered carefully by my colleagues, unquote. He then added that the sentiments expressed in the non-scientific treatise were so vital to our national dialogue that they should, quote, help guide our debate on this issue, unquote. The paper, sponsored by the Witherspoon Institute at Princeton, makes a case for banning same-sex marriage altogether. What's extraordinary is the idea of a United States senator attempting to sway opinion on an amendment that would have altered our Constitution had it not been defeated last Wednesday by using a paper from an organization linked to Opus Dei, a strict religious group that some former members have described as a cult. Brownback spent a good part of his lengthy Senate speech last week citing the study and attributing it to, quote, this Princeton group of scholars, unquote, while never mentioning that all of the findings were based on the ultra-conservative Witherspoon Institute, bolstered by the involvement, directly or indirectly, of a non-profit, tax-exempt religious organization in Opus Dei. So what exactly is the Witherspoon Institute, whose paper formed the foundation of Brownback's anti-gay argument? The Institute, which has only been around since 2003, has close ties to Tony Perkins and the Family Research Council, but is also tightly aligned with Opus Dei. Indeed, Luis Tellez, the president of the Witherspoon Institute, is also the director and lead cleric of Opus Dei in Princeton. Since its founding in 1928, parenthetically the same year that the Muslim Brotherhood was founded by Hassan al-Banna, since its founding in 1928, Opus Dei has been known for its traditionalist values and right-wing political stances. And critics in academia, which include former members who sometimes go through deprogramming upon exiting Opus Dei, charge that organizations like the Witherspoon Institute are just veiled attempts by Opus Dei to spread its influence in top-tier academic circles. So why, then, is a U.S. senator offering to Congress, quote, research, unquote, linked to Opus Dei on something as vital as amending the Constitution? It turns out that Brownback, who was formerly an evangelical Protestant, converted to Catholicism by way of Opus Dei in 2002, and was sponsored in that conversion by Senator Rick Santorum, Republican of Pennsylvania, a vocal Opus Dei advocate. Tellez, the leader of Opus Dei in Princeton, is a numerary, unquote, considered the most conservative of the sect's members. They are unmarried, celibate, devote every aspect of their lives to their spiritual beliefs, and turn over their salaries from secular jobs to Opus Dei. Again, it bears repeating that Tellez is also the head of the Witherspoon Institute, the group Brownback cited at great length as his primary argument against gay marriage. And remember also, it is Brownback, as an Opus Dei convert, who also leads the charge on Capitol Hill against abortion and stem cell research, and who, along with Santorum, is seen by the religious right as a point man on culture war issues. The other central figure in the Witherspoon orbit is Dr. Robert George, a Princeton professor and a board member of the Institute who, not coincidentally, helped draft the federal gay marriage ban that was just defeated in the Senate. George chaired a meeting of religious leaders in late 2005 that included Dr. James Dobson and other members of the extreme religious right. In fact, in addition to his pivotal role in the Witherspoon Institute, George is also a board member at Perkins Family Research Council, a group known for its bigoted positions on the gay community. And, via Brownback, all of this is ultimately finding its way into the halls of Congress. While it may not be technically illegal for Brownback to be so clearly mixing hard-right religious theology and faux academic papers promoted by religious organizations like Opus Dei with debate on the Senate floor, it should certainly raise some eyebrows. In a country where strict separation of church and state is mandated, it seems that Brownback is freely blending the two, attempting to use religious dogma to influence public policy, all the while, not disclosing to his Senate colleagues the background sources of the research he is citing. But this should not be surprising coming from Brownback. In a January 2006 Rolling Stone article, God Senator, Brownback is described as a religious zealot with a view for America's future that could almost be described as medieval. Quote, in his dream, America, the one he believes both the Bible and the Constitution promise, the state will simply wither away. In its place will be a country so suffused with God and the free market that the social fabric of the last 100 years, schools, Social Security, and welfare will be privatized or simply done away with. Reads the article, again quoting, there will be no abortions, sex will be confined to heterosexual marriage, men will lead families, mothers will tend children, and big business and the church will take care of it all. After all, it was Brownback who came to Congress in 1994 and refused to sign Newt Gingrich's contract with America because he felt it wasn't conservative enough. Even then, as a newcomer to the House of Representatives, Brownback believed that the vast majority of what he saw as big government should simply be eliminated, including the departments of education, energy, and commerce. And yes, it was also Brownback who was so outraged at the split-second glimpse of Janet Jackson's nipple during the 2004 Super Bowl that he introduced the Broadcast Decency Enforcement Act, which substantially raised fines for such simple on-air displays of nudity. Finally, in addition to being brought into Catholicism by the likes of Opus Dei and using laundered research by an affiliated group on the Senate floor, Brownback chairs a meeting every Tuesday night with the Values Action Team, consisting of religious leaders like Dobson, who helped the senator formulate his thoughts on public policy issues. According to Time magazine, Opus Dei has assets in the neighborhood of $2.8 billion, and with John McCain unlikely to rouse the religious right in 2008, look for Brownback to be the guy that Opus Dei, Focus on the Family, and the Family Research Council turn to as their presidential candidate. And make no mistake about it, Brownback wants to run. So if you think his views for a new America as viewed from the Senate floor are scary, think of what he'll be like sitting at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. In his mind, it may already be ordained. Well, in and of itself, actually, Brownback's views are not really all that different from other religious rightists. Do note, however, his affiliation with Opus Dei, a fascist prelature within the Vatican, one that wields great influence over this pope as it did over the last pope, and an organization that is now creeping through the courtesy of Senator Brownshirt and others into the debate on the floor of the United States Senate, and if they would have their way, into the very Constitution itself. What we're going to look at next concerns some maneuvering around the ongoing inquiry into the murder of Roberto Calvi. Now, inside one of this program, we heard reference from the book Men of God, or People of God, by Penny Lernoux, that basically the Opus Dei infrastructure within the Vatican had a lot to do with the maneuvering around the collapse of the Banco Ambrosiano. That collapse ultimately resulted not only in the severe embarrassment of the Vatican, which had guaranteed many of the loans which went bad for Ambrosiano, but it also revealed the fascist P2 Lodge, a crypto-fascist government that wielded profound influence in Italy for decades and continues to. Although we're not going to have time to go into it at great length here, I do want to note that the P2 Lodge, which we're going to be talking about in a second, has profound influence within the recently departed Berlusconi administration. Berlusconi was a member of the P2 Lodge, and there are very strong links between the P2 milieu and the Banco Ambrosiano and the Bank Altaqua nexus, such as Banco del Gottardo, those spoken about in, among other programs, For the Records 356 and 357, and For the Record program number 456. And those broadcasts will be linked to the description for the Record 559 on the Spitfire website. Now, one of the things that we looked at in For the Record 521 was the fact that P2 Lodge Grand Master Licio Gelli, known as Il Venerabile, the old respected one, and the puppet master in Italian political society, Licio Gelli was called upon to give testimony in connection with the English inquiry into the murder of Roberto Calvi and the collapse of the Banco Ambrosiano, as discussed in People of God by Penny Lernoux in Side 1. Opus Dei was involved with the maneuvering and around that particular treacherous episode as well. Returning now to an article that we looked at from the London Independent from July 22nd of 2005, the following about Licio Gelli giving testimony in connection with the death of Roberto Calvi. Now, notice the time frame that is taking place here. This is July of 2005. Bear in mind that if Licio Gelli really starts talking, a whole lot of people and a whole lot of institutions all over the world are going to be seriously compromised. And as we looked at in, among other programs, For the Record programs, AFA programs 17 through 21, anti-fascist archive shows 17 through 21, an investigation into the events surrounding the shooting of Pope John Paul II would crack open the history of the 20th and now the 21st century to a major extent. Of Licio Gelli giving testimony in the inquiry into the death of Roberto Calvi, the London Independent had the following to say on July 22nd of 2005. Magistrates investigating the death of the Italian banker Roberto Calvi under Blackfriars Bridge in London in 1982 are focusing on Licio Gelli, the former Grand Master of the illegal P2 Masonic Lodge that plotted against Italian democracy in the 1970s. Mr. Gelli denies he was involved, but has acknowledged that the financier known as God's Banker because of his links with the Vatican was murdered. He said the killing was commissioned in Poland, unquote. Well, we'll see exactly what, if anything, comes of Licio Gelli's testimony. What I want to point out is the synchrony, basically the course of events that took place shortly after that. Now, Gelli has something to say behind closed doors in July of 2005. In January of 2006, Mehmet Ali Ajah, the convicted assassin of the Pope, a member of the Turkish Grey Wolves, the youth wing of the Turkish Nationalist and Fascist Party, the National Action Party, was released from prison. Again, this is January 12th of 2006. Article from, among other publications, USA Today, had the following AP story. Turk who shot Pope John Paul II is released from prison. After 25 years behind bars for trying to assassinate Pope John Paul II and fatally gunning down a journalist, Mehmet Ali Ajah was released from prison and promptly gave his supporters and his enemies the slip. Upon release, Ajah said one of the first things he wanted to do was to order a typical Turkish meal of beans and rice. Within hours of tasting Freedom Thursday for the first time since wounding John Paul in 1981, Ajah disappeared out the back door of a military hospital. He left behind hordes of journalists along with questions about whether he will be forced to complete the mandatory military service he dodged as a young man. Scores of ultra-nationalist right-wing supporters cheered his release and tossed flowers at the sedan that whisked him through the gates of a high-security prison. This is in Istanbul, by the way. But many Turks expressed dismay that Ajah 48 served just 5 years for the slaying of newspaper columnist Abdi Ipeki in 1979 during a time of street violence between rightists and leftists. Justice Minister Cemal Çiçek ordered a review to see whether any errors were committed in releasing him. He said Ajah would remain free until an appeals court reviewed the case. Well, again, I want to note that this took place a few months after Licio Gelli began talking, and if one begins examining the evidentiary tributaries running from the Grey Wolves, one moves in one direction to the National Action Party and some of the Earth Island elements that have collaborated with fascism since really before World War II, through the course of the Second World War, and through the various anti-communist networks that grew out of not only the Third Reich's intelligence networks, but other fascist networks during World War II as well. We took a look at the Pan-Turkist movement in, among other broadcasts, For the Record 549. It is part of the pantheon of fascist elements that is in the orbit of the UNPO, And that's an orbit which merges various native peoples, even including elements of the Lakota tribes in the United States, with other, quote, native, unquote, peoples, in many cases, of fascist orientation, ranging from some of the elements around the Dalai Lama to Islamo-fascists associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, to the aforementioned fascist elements within the Pan-Turkist movement as well. That Pan-Turkist movement includes Mehmet Ali Agha, other associates of Mehmet Ali Agha, such as Aral Çelik, crop up in connection with intelligence community heroin smuggling that involves SECO, the Saudi investment company, and elements associated with that firm. SECO was sending its pilots to be trained at Huffman Aviation down in Florida. Now, Mehmet Ali Agha is released from prison in January of 2006, and the long-discredited Bulgarian thesis surfaces about 2 months later. One wonders what sorts of strings are being pulled behind the scenes, and also just what exactly is going on. If, in fact, Turkey is to become a member of the EU, it's a safe bet that having the Turkish ultranationalists blamed for the shooting of the Pope, as well as heroin trafficking and other things, is not something that the Turks are going to want on the front burner. But who knows? I suspect that the sequence of events resurrecting the Bulgarian thesis and seeing the release of Agha has a lot to do with Licio Gelli rattling some verbal sabers in his testimony in the inquiry of the death of Roberto Calvi. If anybody could be said to know where the bodies are buried, it's Licio Gelli. The LA Times of March 3rd of 2006 announced the Italian resurrection of the Bulgarian hypothesis that we went into at great length in AFA program 17 through 21, available from Spitfire. Following article by Tracy Wilkinson, an LA Times staff writer, Soviets behind Pope shooting, Italy panel says. Lawmakers conclude Pope John Paul II's stance against communism made him a target. And again, AFA shows 17 through 21, available from Spitfire, go into this. There are a number of For the Record shows talking about this as well. This article reads in part, "It has persisted as one of the most mysterious cases of international intrigue in recent times. Who shot the Pope? A committee of Italy's parliament investigating the 1981 attempt to assassinate John Paul II released its conclusion Thursday that, quote, beyond any reasonable doubt, unquote, the Soviet Union ordered the attack that seriously wounded the Pope as he greeted crowds in St. Peter's Square. The Turkish gunman, Mehmet Ali Agha, was long ago condemned in the shooting and served 19 years in jail, but for whom he worked has never been definitely established. His own confessions have been all over the map. He had variously implicated the Soviets, the Bulgarians, and others. Rumors about the intellectual authors of the attack have circulated for years, but pinning it directly and formally on the Soviet Union would be a first. Senator Paolo Guzzanti, president of the paramilitary committee, told reporters that the Soviet military intelligence agency, the GRU, quote, took the initiative to eliminate, unquote, the Pope. According to Italian media, the report says the Soviets had decided that John Paul, a fervent anti-communist, had become dangerous in his outspoken support for the Solidarity protest movement in his native Poland. Solidarity's activities eventually helped precipitate the fall of communism there in 1989. In those Cold War years of intrigue and deception, the shooting of the Pope was tangled in a web of secret agents, proxy gunmen, and the life-or-death struggle over who would dominate the world. Well, to make a long story short, the available evidence with regard to the shooting of the Pope not only makes it that appear, not only suggests that it was a provocation, that it was actually fascist elements associated with the P2 involving the collaboration of various elements of various Western intelligence agencies, including German, some of the Shackley-Klein's-related elements of our own intelligence service, and also drug-relating elements associated not only with elements of Western intelligence, the P2 Lodge, but also with the National Action Party that were behind the shooting of Pope John Paul II, which appears to have been a provocation from the right rather than an attempt at snuffing John Paul from the Soviets and the left. Again, order those shows from Spitfire. I would note also that in Poland as well, once again, the Bulgarian thesis is being dragged out. One wonders to what extent this resurrection of the Bulgarian hypothesis is not only due to Licio Gelli running his mouth in Italy, but also to the resurrected Cold War as well. In any event, from the Turkish Press website, turkishpress.com, Poland opens inquiry into the 1981 John Paul II death plot. Dateline Warsaw, June 12, 2006, it reads in part, investigators in Poland said Monday they have opened an inquiry into a suspected plot behind an assassination attempt on the late Polish-born Pope John Paul II in 1981. The inquiry is not into the attack itself, but also into a plot by communist secret services, said Ewa Kozh of Poland's National Remembrance Institute, or IPN, which is charged with prosecuting communist and Nazi crimes. I would also note that in this same time period, Archbishop Paul Marcinkus, the Lithuanian-American head of the Vatican Bank, and the bodyguard of Pope John Paul II when he was shot, he died in this very same time period without ever having been formally deposed in connection with the collapse of the Banco Ambrosiano. Now, Marcinkus was an old man, but still one wonders to what extent the timing of his demise may have had something to do with these ongoing inquiries. Again, note that the Grey Wolves and their related drug trafficking not only goes to some of the Sub Rosa intelligence activities of the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, but also through SICO, through the Shikarki brothers, possibly even through to some of the controlled drug shipments that we saw in connection with Huffman Aviation, the site for SICO training its airline subsidiaries' pilots. Also note that we see some of the pan-Turkist-related elements in connection with the Dalai Lama and the UNPO milieu, basically Erkin Alptekin epitomizing that connection, the former employee of Radio Free Europe, and also an intimate of the Dalai Lama and on a member of the board of directors of the Dalai Lama Foundation. Now, we have gone into an awful lot of material during the course of this broadcast and made, sadly, only passing references to a great deal more material in order to understand the P2 Lodge and the quarter of a century plus inquiry that I've been engaging in into Vatican power politics. Do access not only the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com, but the related websites, the search websites, other related websites which will help you to gain a more complete understanding of this very important but sadly very little known connection. Do also contact Spitfire, those of you who are serious about pursuing this research, and get a hold of the broadcast dealing with the shooting of the Pope and the P2 Lodge. There are many other For the Record programs in both print and audio file dealing with Opus Dei, with the P2 Lodge, with the shooting of the Pope, with the Grey Wolves. Please take advantage of those websites in order to flesh out your understanding. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 559, the Opus Dei Code, being recorded on June 18th of 2006. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.